Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today's episode marks perhaps a kind of turning point in terms of the mission of this podcast. Our focus has always been on the future of the agri-food system, but our lens in pursuing that future has been on leadership, the role of leadership across the sector, and in particular, the diverse forms and means by which that leadership manifests. And today's guest, Sarah Elton, is no exception. Sarah is an incredibly talented, ridiculously smart, and particularly incisive when it comes to not only having a curiosity of systems, but a literacy of those systems, an ability to explain those systems to people who are both inside and outside of them. And of course, agriculture, agri-food, is a very system-centric sector. Every farmer understands the systems they run on their farm. Every processor understands the systems that produce food. And Sarah really brings it back down to fundamentals, to foundations of both a society, but also science and values. And I kind of describe this as a turning point because I feel after a bit of a heat-induced and holiday break that the Future Herd is really starting to shape, take form, starting to have a certain sense of mission, which hasn't changed in terms of understanding the future of the agri-food sector, but it also recognizes why the sector needs more people, more talent, more perspective. And Sarah Elton brings that in spades. I mean, this is someone whose career started in journalism, moved from there into sort of long-form writing, then into academia, now in the height of research and teaching and writing. This is exactly the kind of leader that the agri-food sector should be courting, should be embracing, should be empowering. Because the perspectives that Sarah brings really fills a lot of the missing pieces, a lot of the gaps, a lot of the missed opportunities when it comes to turning Canada into an agri-food powerhouse. That may seem a little paradoxical once you wade into the depths of this fantastic episode, but I'm saying this as kind of a preview of where I suspect this podcast is going to be moving forward when it comes to not only speculating on the future of the agri-food sector, but actually implementing, executing, and deploying the future of the agri-food sector here on the Future Herd. All right, that's enough hype. This is another one of those fire episodes that you're going to want to listen to. So let's tune in. Sarah, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thanks, Jesse. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, I think this episode will be a little different from the others in that you and I have known each other for quite some time, and I encourage you today to do what I'm going to do, which is partly catch up and get to know all the fascinating things that you've been up to, because as a researcher, you seem to connect systems, not just study systems, but connect systems in a way that not a lot of researchers do. And granted, I've been interviewing researchers on this podcast, as you know, and they may take a systems view, but I kind of feel you're the first to take a, for lack of a better phrase, like a meta systems view. So as a kind of starting off question, although let me pause right there and say that'll be the second question. I almost forgot. The first question of every episode of the Future Herd is a very abstract, kind of Rorschach test style of what does the future mean to you?
Ooh. Do people usually answer with a sigh?
Yes.
I'm not really feeling great about the future right now. I'm actually trying not to think about the future because it's truly crushing if we think of the, interconnections of climate change, inequality, war, fascism, AI. What else? What am I missing? I'm sure I forgot. So to work and survive as a very privileged, fortunate person who lives an extraordinary good life at the time of multiple collapses, I just try to be in the moment and appreciate. I know this might sound funny, but the seasons, and really appreciate my bioregion and where I am, as a way of, count, like, not thinking about the bad stuff. That said, right now my bioregion is having a major windstorm, and so that is like a little inflaming of one's anxiety.
I hear you. I also got a tornado warning today, although I think our conversation may be safe before that extreme weather hits me in Eastern Ontario. But we've already kind of evoked systems, and I was so eager to start getting you to kind of talk about your approach to systems and how you connect systems. That I almost forgot that first question. And to your point, people's answers to that question are really excellent icebreakers because they evoke systems and they evoke our relationship with systems, which not everyone's conscious of. You are. With other guests, I kind of have to tease it out. But what I think as long as I've known you, you've been interested in systems. So I guess the larger question is, when did you start connecting them? Like, when in your either journalism or your research or your teaching, did you start realizing the real fun is not just studying a single system, but looking at how multiple systems kind of interconnect and play with each other?
Oh, that's such an interesting question, Jesse. I don't know, because I've never thought of it that way. But certainly, when I was writing books as a journalist, I loved to write about systems. Like, that was so cool to see how the and learn about how the industrial food system worked. And as a journalist, you have this wonderful opportunity to learn by calling up people and asking if you can come and spend some time with them. And now I know, because I'm an academic, not everybody gets the same opportunity. So you could go to, I went to, a grain elevator and supermarkets and farms around, like literally around the world and on many continents, and learned about the food system by interviewing people and talking to people and also reading scientific papers and putting all that together. And I wrote a couple books about that. And that's what inspired me to go back to school to do a PhD, because I felt like I'm like, oh, I want to be doing the research that I'm writing about other people's research. I want to do the research myself. So that's when I went back to university. And I didn't end up doing what I thought I was going to be doing because I learned about post-humanist theory. And so I think the answer to your question lies in reading about philosophy that makes the human, takes the human, what they say, on the same ontological plane. That means nothing to 99.9% of people, but that is the seeing the human as not more important than other life forms and ecosystems on the planet, to see the human being as equally as having agency, like can make things happen just as much as the wind right now is perhaps making the internet connection. So I can't really see your face because it's blurry, because that's the agency of the wind, and so that entry into this world of what's called critical social science and critical theory really was super fun and exciting and helped me to think with what we call more than humans, which are all the life forms and things that get categorized as nature. And I did my PhD thinking about plants and people, and now in the last few years I've been working with microorganisms and people. And then I realized, I was like, wait a second, how can I even separate these things? It's absurd. Like, it's all like, I am plant, I am microbiome, because I be through the food system. So that's right now I'm working, like this morning I spent working on a talk I'm giving next week, where I'll be talking about how the colon, making the argument that the colon actually should be considered to be part of the food system, because based on what we know and what's emerging in the microbiology literature.
So the synapses in my brain are firing at a pace that will make me asking questions kind of difficult, because there'll be so many thoughts that I'll be trying to fuse in. But I for sure want to come back to the colon and the microbiome, if only because I do think it is a fascinating area of research that I think changes our notion of what an individual is at a core level, amongst all sorts of system implications. But you said a couple of things there I want to stitch together into a kind of follow-up question. On the one hand, it was interesting to see you as an academic acknowledge kind of the privilege that journalists take for granted, right? That journalists often get access to conversations, partly because of the institutional power. You call saying you're the CBC, people are going to dish, they're going to spill. And you're right that academics and researchers often have a lot more difficulty with that. And if you want, by all means, you could talk about some of the controversy here in Ontario around researchers and the food system and access to producers and some of the laws that try to restrict that. But I want to focus on one specific example before we go further, because I think you and I are going to get some pretty crazy stuff today. The locavore. You were writing about kind of local food and local consumption of food production before a lot of people were even conscious of this stuff. And I kind of feel that that's afforded you a position to see this concept evolve, to see the literacy around local food evolve. And I'm curious about your perspective there. Right? Has it played out the way you initially thought when you were first a journalist going, there's something here, compared to now where the industry seems to be using the same language you were using, although in different contexts and in different frames? So I'm curious, as someone who has been there, who's done that knowledge work, what your perspective is on the way that local food culture and our literacy of the locavore, right? How that has evolved over the years that you've been writing and I assume now teaching about that kind of stuff.
Well, certainly the story starts like the more one learns, the more one sees the story as being very, very long. So, you know, way, way into the last century, you know, local food, people have been wanting to, you know, protect food systems from what they saw as, you know, impurities, or, you know, make them more natural for generations. And like we see a lot of this, you know, 100 years ago, but then in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s. So by the time the early 2000s come along, the local food movement that I wrote about in my book Locavore that came out in 2010, so that was, gosh, 16 years ago, that really was, I think, a response to that next stage of industrialization that had happened. Like, I certainly know I was writing from that. Like, I remembered a time before there were boxes of lettuce from California at the supermarket. I remembered a time when, you know, when you could only get strawberries in season, and asparagus was something that came from Ontario exclusively. And so I think people like me were thinking, hey, something's happening, something's changing. There's more, I remember when President's Choice invented all those food products and sauces, and everyone was so excited in my family, for sure. And so we remembered these changes felt quick, and then suddenly I think there was like that movement, oh, let's bring back farmers markets, we need to reconnect with local food. And that certainly was, as you say, You could say co-opted, but you know, you go into now a major chain supermarket and see a farmer's market stand inside the supermarket that's not really a farmer's market stand, and many other examples of how like sustainability concerns of the local food movement have become used to talk about sustainable beef and sustainable, you know, production of all sorts of foods. And in some ways, it's a really great thing. And in some situations, and they're obviously talking about making industrial food systems that have so many problems with unsustainability and inequity, figuring out ways of making them less kind of a contribution to climate change. And that's like, we will put all, I'm going to just put that aside and say, so you asked me, like, did I know what would happen? Well, I'll tell you what has been most surprising has been in the last year, where I would never have imagined that. Obviously, I mean, like all Canadians, that threats to our national security would provoke such a widespread. I mean, this is more than 2010 when the farmers markets were coming back in some ways, that there's been such a surge. Like, people will just say, like, volunteer to me, I don't buy American food anymore, I want to buy only Canadian. I don't actually think that that's true or possible, given my experience and observations at the supermarket, but nevertheless, this nationalist fervor has given new fuel to local food movements. And what's the most surprising is that now it's, because we know our national, we have the new national food security strategy announced last week, that it's what was more grassroots before has now become state-led. Doesn't mean that the goals are the same. Doesn't mean that the mechanisms for localizing are the same. However, this idea that a country needs to have regional and local food systems to have food security, that I would say has now become like a national project. Well, we know it has, because of the more than $3 billion that were pledged to that last week. So, massive change. Could I have predicted that? I don't think so, because of the sequence of events.
But it does, to your point, speak to a rapidly changing landscape, which does not necessarily mean that the objectives or policy outcomes we desire will manifest, but it creates all sorts of opportunities. And I do kind of want to get us to the kind of post-humanist systems and theories. But I think a natural through line for you has been critical theory and critical thinking. And I'd love for you to kind of talk about how that has been either a driver or a facilitator, not just of your research, but also your teaching. Because what I'm hearing in your language and in your conversation is you're situating yourself within, you know, a larger milieu of scholarship, a larger kind of, you know, a diversity of voices who are, once you go outside of the kind of dominant narrative of agri-food in Canada, you start realizing that there are a lot of people raising a lot of really interesting critical issues. So I'd love to hear about kind of the role that critical theory plays in the work and teaching that you do.
Oh, interesting question. So the way right now, I feel like I have these like two areas. One where I do empirical work on food systems, where I think about climate change, sustainability, and justice. Like, how can we have what makes a food system that feeds us all? And then I'm gonna put like scare quotes around all, because then with my work with critical theory, I like think about, okay, who is the all? And And we, of course, mean all people, because all people we know in Canada do not have access because they're food insecure. In fact, the statistics are alarming for the number of people, you know, around 20+% are food insecure in Canada. So by all, we need a food system that ensures that everybody has access to healthy food. But also the all being from, like, how does this food system sustain us all? We can't sustain ourselves tomorrow if we don't think of the all as being plants and microbes and trees and the soil rhizosphere and the, you know, all life. And so that just, that, which is where I'm now working, to try to bring my empirical and theoretical work together more and more, to be able to think about food systems from, sometimes I call it an ecological public health perspective, sometimes I call it a post-humanist perspective, depends on how I feel today and who I'm talking to. But, like, yeah, trying to think about health, not as a condition that I possess in my body, but as a condition that exists across systems. And I'm speaking ecological systems, but we can't, the food system, as you and I know very well, is a socio-ecological system. So it includes technology, and it includes politics and policy and social structures and all these other things that make it what it is, the complicated, fascinating thing that it is.
Well, and the reason I kind of honed in on theory is, and critical theory in particular, is I'm certainly finding, both as I age, but also as I kind of encounter different cultures, younger cultures, that theory is often scarce, that the kind of thinking that theory enables is kind of scarce. I think you and I grew up and kind of came of age in cultures where it was in abundance, where there were lots of people engaging with theory and playing with theory. And I say this because, as a kind of transition to use like the microbiome as an example, you know, on the one hand, I find there is a growing ecological awareness for people outside of the body. Like, you know, a hunter, you can talk about the natural environment. A farmer, you can talk to about the ecological environment around their farm. I have difficulty having conversations with those same people about the microbiome. That it applies the same system principles, but it kind of requires an abstract thinking, a theoretical apparatus to kind of understand the concept of the microbiome. I say that as a setup to, how do you explain the microbiome to people who are not in your field or you're happen to be breaking bread with, and they're like, hey, what are you passionate about? You're like, well, let me tell you about your colon. How do you frame it in a way that is accessible but still maintains the kind of the critical perspectives, the systems theory that you're bringing to it?
I've been asked by my children not to talk, not to proselytize anymore about the microbiome, because when I was first starting to read this science, I like literally, it was during the pandemic, and I, you know, was spending Friday night reading scientific papers, like learning as much as I could. Like, it's like the most incredible, fascinating thing in the whole world. And so the way if I'm permitted, or if my kids aren't around, then I can tell somebody I could say we're not human, because we live with many different microorganisms in our bodies that play all sorts of important roles, often through food, our relationship with food, such as, you know, synthesizing metabolites that are like short chain fatty acids that reduce inflammation, to enabling us to be nourished, there's gut microbiome can plays a role with the brain. I don't do anything with the brain. I have, like, as a systems researcher, everything is connected, but you have to put artificial boundaries, because it's absolutely impossible. So to learn about even practically one area. So I think about plants and microbes, but yeah, there's the gut brain axis. I just learned about the other day, the shoulder has a microbiome. Our eyes have microbiomes. The lung has a microbiome. Like, we're just fundamentally microbial. And as a food systems researcher, I tell them that, and so what you eat determines in part this community that you live with that plays this really important role for your health.
And so how
does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And give me a few examples. And I mean that both on the research level in terms of the types of questions or the types of, you know, kind of inquiries. Now that you've been infected with this fascinating subject area, you know, how are you playing with it? What are the kind of research questions that you're trying to go? But then to the point of your kids, I assume this is affecting how you eat and how you think about food yourself, because that is kind of the nature of theory, that it ends up influencing action. So again, to further unpack this concept of the microbiome and how you're approaching it, give me a research example and give me a kind of, you know, personal adaptation example.
Okay, I have to just write down the three parts of that question. So theory, eating, and research itself. Okay, I'm gonna go start with the research itself. So for example, one area that I'm working on right now, well, I gave a presentation recently on, was very practical public health focus, because I'm in a school of public health. And so I was like, even if you follow the Canada Food Guide, because people who do ask me, my friends will say, oh, you know, what is it? And they say, oh, but I don't eat any ultra processed foods, because we know ultra processed foods are generally bad for the microbiome. And so what I say is, well, even if you follow the Canada Food Guide, there are all sorts of additives in your food that are damaging either to the microbes themselves, to your mucosal lining of your colon, which is where the microbes live, or that synthesize, the microbes then take, for example, azo dyes, break them down and turn them into something else, another substance that kills other microbes in your gut. So if you eat many of the foods that are available to us at the supermarket, even if you're not eating like something that some people would call, you know, unhealthy bad food, you can end up like carrageenan that you'll find in half and half. Let's just talk about breakfast. Carrageenan in your half and half goes in the coffee. Carrageenan, no, you don't want to eat that. You have carboxyl methyl cellulose in the muffin. Let's say you're going gluten free because you think that's going to be better for you. Well, it's going to be made with carboxyl methyl cellulose, probably. That's really not good for you either. Gosh, what else could you have? Oh, and then maybe you have a bagel with some cream cheese or cottage cheese. Let's put cottage cheese on the side. That's going to be full of emulsifiers and other ingredients, preservatives that are also going to do a number on your gut microbiome. So even when you're following this Canada Food Guide, you're eating things that are damaging to you and your communities of microbes. And so how does this affect my eating fundamentally? What we eat, there's been like radical changes, and not just luckily, my whole family, from my like my parents to my sister's family, everybody eats what we call in our family the gut diet. And so we eat a lot of fiber, because that's in like fruits and vegetables and beans and nuts and all these things, because the microbes break those down, the fibers down, and produce all sorts of healthy metabolites for us with that. So it has changed our eating for better or for better, obviously. Sometimes the younger folks would say for worse, because they miss, they know. It's not like they don't believe it or know. Like they are old enough, they understand, but they miss a time when they didn't have to know this, the burden of truth, which is that the food system produces all this stuff that they shouldn't be eating. And then in terms of theory, actually, because I've been reading post-humanist theory, I was in a workshop yesterday, and and they were talking about how you need to read theory, and how you're constantly, you need to be constantly reading, and your understanding was like, the way the presenter was describing it was like your understanding was constantly evolving. And I really love that, because it really it is true. Your one's understanding constantly evolves. And so I've been reading posthumanist theory since probably around 2015, when I was 2016, when I was in my first year of my PhD, preparing for my comprehensive exam. It's now like fused into the way I think and even talk. So in posthumanism, we see other creatures than other than humans as doing things, as participating in social life and cultural life and politics. And so I can't help but see the world animated by these things. That, like, I can see, for, you know, if I make pickles, someone says I do a lot of fermentation because it's good to eat fermented foods. So I'll be like, someone will say, oh, your pickles are so good. You made them. No, I didn't make them. The microbes made them. And I'm not being cute. That's like literally theory. As you said, it really shapes the way you see the world. Or when I see the government making the decision to increase the highway, increase highways across agricultural lands in Toronto. Like it is just so clear that this is damaging to health and human health, right? Like it's just the once you take the human out of the center and you decenter the human, as they say, you like it's a different world that you see. Now, I really need to pause for a second and do this really important thing, which is to acknowledge that this is not a new perspective. Like in Euro-Western thought, this idea that that humans are not the center of the universe might be something that is feels new, but it is by no means. And it like indigenous peoples here on Turtle Island in Abya-Yala, which is the a name for South America, the other parts of the Americas, an indigenous name, and then peoples on all continents have been thinking this way. So it's really important for people like me to what we call decolonize posthumanism and make sure that you really situate the work that's done by people like me in the context and in dialogue even with other ways of knowing, other philosophies that are not Euro-Western centric. And this is done a lot, and particularly like great work out of Australia. There's some like really interesting scholarship there where settler scholars are working with indigenous communities and indigenous scholars to really do amazing research into that animates our understanding of our relationships in the world.
Well, and you're correct in saying that it's not new, but I think it is important in acknowledging that it's currently marginalized. And I say this because it my engagement with the sector is discombobulating to me, for lack of a better phrase, because I am privy to the kind of thinking and work that you do, that Charles Levko does, that a lot of the people who I've been around for decades have done, and I don't see it acknowledged. I don't see it kind of part of the narrative landscape that the sector addresses. And to me, that's dysfunctional. That's a mistake, that there's a need to make sure, even for the purposes of science, if not for the purposes of a better, more inclusive food system, to make sure that all those voices and perspectives are part of the policy process, are part of the debate process. And here's where I'll say, as an aside, feel encouraged to go as radical and provocative, as incendiary as possible in the time that we have left. But let me ask you a very pointed question. And I do want to come back to the colon, by the way. A lot of the guests that I've had on the show, a lot of the voices, the leadership of the agri-food sector, demonize regulation, right? To them, regulation is one of the specters that haunt their desire for prosperity, for innovation, for being a better industry, a better sector, a better society. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts, partly because on the one hand, I assume you don't want to see them adding ingredients like without any testing, without any approval, without any knowledge into our food system. But on the other hand, I suspect that you are suspicious of state power and the way in which regulation can normalize things that may not be good. I'm rambling. I don't know where I'm going with this question other than to say you clearly have a really sharp, well-informed, well-researched, critical perspective on the sector. What role do you think regulation can play, either in mitigating the harms that you're addressing or in facilitating the kind of more inclusive, justice, sustainable food system that you're advocating for and working towards?
Wow, what a great way of just painting that problem. As in, you know, like we need regulation to be, that's what society provides us with, right? Rules to keep, that we help each other to keep us, each other safe and well. But then yet whose power is reproduced through regulation? So when it comes to people saying they don't like regulation, I would wonder if perhaps it's that they don't like some regulations because probably people want to be able to, you know, turn on the tap and drink water that's not going to give them dysentery or have PFAS chemicals in it that's going to destroy your health, or breathe air that gives you lung cancer, or your food. You like knowing that you can go to the store and buy food, and that it's probably because of the food safety certification, it's very less likely to have like E. coli on your spinach, for example. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. We know it does, but right, that's exactly why there are these incredible complex systems. And I like, frankly, I know I talk about alternative food systems, but when the more I study the mainstream industrial production that's like across the globe that can bring spinach from, you know, thousands of kilometers away, and it's like clean and safe to eat and I can eat it, it's like true and it's fresh, as in it's not rotted, I can eat this, is truly awe-inspiring and incredible. So, and that's because of regulation, right? Like it's like truly regulate, you know, all the, how it gets shipped. Is it bonded? Does it, you know, what kind of permits? Does it have to travel through this country to get to that country? So I think like people who say they don't like regulation, probably it's because so much of the regulation that makes our lives as comfortable as they are right now are invisible to us. Like that's part of us not, I always say, like the government, the city government in particular, municipalities, should hire like a PR firm to tell people like what is all this policy and government actually do? Like, do, like, your garbage gets taken away, you have clean water, your toilet flushes, generally, like, wow, what a privilege to live in much of Canada. I recognize not everybody shares the same experiences across this country. So that's, you know, we need regulation, and we really need regulation, as you said, about ingredients in food that's not there. So that's a really great example of like whose interests are reproduced in the regulations around food. Like the, for example, you could take two examples of whipping cream. I looked at this the other day, and one had ingredients that I don't want to put in my body in it. And the other had none of that. And it was whipping cream, and it was the one that had none of it. It's not more expensive. In fact, it was like, I think it was like even a little bit less expensive. And furthermore, it was more. It was like 500 mils versus 475 mils. Okay, so why is that additive? I believe it was carrageenan in one of the brands of whipping cream. Well, that's because the corporation wants to put it in because it helps them to maximize their profits. And it's not a health question. It's not a quality question. I can tell you that anybody who likes high quality, delicious stuff is probably going to be able to taste the difference between those two creams. And the one without the carrageenan is going to taste better. So the one reason to put it in there is profit, and that could have to do with mouthfeel. It could also have, like, do people like the way it holds together over the time on the shelf? But usually it's about like making sure we can sell something with an extended shelf time. And again, that comes back to profit. So whose interests are reflected in standards often have to do with money making as opposed to what's best for health. And I don't just mean human health. I mean we need to be thinking again, as I've been saying, across systems about ecological health because the food safety and often comes up against ecological health. Like if you think of food throwing out things or you know, putting plastic gloves on to make a sandwich. At a sandwich store, someone's putting on plastic gloves. That's for food safety reasons. So now you're putting an appearance of food safety versus ecological health, which is also your health as a human being, because those gloves are going in the garbage and they've been made with all sorts of resources are embedded in the making of them. And also, I had I have a PhD student who has a fascinating PhD looking at gloves. And I will just say that they are not the sterile gloves that we think that they are. And so that is, we should stay tuned for this wonderful research because often things, that's just yet another example of things that you assume to be true when you actually look at them. They're not true. Not to
Well,
the
and
little side of
it goes back to my other point that if we, the sector.
Actually, can I just jump one thing? Like that's the I'm gonna finish. Sorry, I just that like that's the brilliance of critical theory because theory allows us to learn how what we know about the world and how we make sense of the world is not natural. It's produced by the way we were raised, by how we came to learn about the world, about by our culture, by our values, all these things that make us who we are, help us to interpret the world and understand and make sense of things. So when we have critical theory, when we read critical theory and philosophy, we're like we learn about how like different things cause stigma and inequities, and different people have their power is expressed in this way or that way. And so I was I it would be wonderful if we all I know we're moving towards a time where, you know, is anyone going to read anymore if you can just put something into a AI reader and get the bullet notes from it. However, we're at a time where we need to be reading more. We need to be engaging with these like centuries of ideas across civilizations to grapple with this very complex and troubling time that we're living in right now.
Well, and I think that's the argument as to why I think the sector needs to acknowledge and cease the marginalization of critical voices. Because to have dissenting voices, to have different voices, to have, to your point, students who are going off in random directions that no one else would have thought about, that benefits all of us, even if you don't agree with the conclusions. So let me throw another kind of advanced, difficult question at you, because you clearly have imbued the principles of public health into a lot of your research, a lot of the way in which you approach some of the challenges, some of the problems, some of the concepts that interest you. I think a lot of people can acknowledge that public health took quite a beating at the hands of the conspiracists and the fascists over the course of the last 6 years. And at the same time, public health is ever more important. We're watching an Ebola outbreak in the Congo become incredibly dangerous and impactful. How do you approach public health in a post-institutional setting? And I say this in the sense that I don't want to hear your thoughts on what the Toronto or Ontario or Canada public health should, like, what should a public health revolutionary be thinking about in the polycrisis that we find ourselves in? And I say this because the tragedy I was being reminded of when you were just giving your last example was how, on the one hand, in the early days of the COVID outbreak, people became obsessed with sterilizing surfaces, as if sterilizing surfaces would help them. But then they didn't bother wearing masks once we started to understand that the virus was airborne. And yet, sterilizing surfaces, that's not so great for our biome. Like, again, there's so much nuance, so much complication to the way in which this messaging has to play out. Part of your brilliance is you do have a media background, so you learned storytelling at a very early point in your career. But how do you conceive of public health in the conspiracy era, right? How do you encourage your students or critically minded folks to play public health the way others play public education when it comes to it? At least you got your family eating fiber. But how do we carry that forward in this social movement sort of sense?
Oh my gosh, it's like front row seat to the information wars, right? Public health, food, health. Like, we, you know, it's really exciting place to research and truth, right? This, like, in this post-truth world, what is true? And I think that what part of the problem is that science, positivist science, what we call positive science, the kind of science that emerged in the Euro-Western world, starting, you know, back in the Enlightenment, that has like a specific way of doing science. There are other sciences out there, but this particular science that says, you know, there's one truth, we can find it if we measure and study it, and once we do this investigation, we can figure out what is the truth, and our way, this scientific way, is the legitimate way of producing knowledge. And there's lots of people in the Western Academy and beyond that have challenged this, including, of course, other ways of knowing that challenge this way of doing science that claimed, like, we have the truth. This is the truth, have been challenged by many, 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 many scholars. So I'm just repeating what they're saying here. But this, to me, is the problem now, is that with this claim on the truth is not actually true, right? Like, it's more complicated than there just being one thing that we can measure. Like, the COVID pandemic is a perfect example, as you said, you know, like, sometimes you don't know, and sometimes many things are true, and that are complicated and really hard to understand. And I don't mean hard for the public to understand, I mean hard for the people who are doing the research to understand. And so the idea that there's only one right answer, I think has contributed to this, like, massive alienation from science and public health. And that part of the solution, like, I mean, this is just such a massive problem that so many people are thinking about, but part of the solution, I think, in my little way, has to do with recognizing that there are different ways of producing knowledge beyond this one particular way. Now, that does not mean that I am saying that I'm anti-vaccine, for example. Like, there's certain things that are factually inaccurate, right? Like, a vaccine does not cause, that the MMR vaccine does not cause autism. Full stop. This is not about valuing, you know, different perspectives. Oh, no, there's, like, some things are true, some things are false. But But what I think is important to make it through this complicated post-truth world is figuring out a way for to validate different ways of coming to understand what is true.
And this is a very
So
brief
for me, that
tangent.
would be like more difficult.
Well, and let me take a brief tangent because I am conscious that we're almost out of time. How do we get journalists to adopt what you just said? And I say this because I know a lot of people who have worked in journalism who have come to the conclusion you have. But I still regularly encounter people who are in power in the media and cultural industries who still arrogantly assert the opposite of what you just described. I assume you encounter these people as well. How do you handle that conflict?
You know what? I live in a sometimes a bit of a bubble at the university, right? So I'm not dealing with people too much who I have I actually like when I do because I research with people, I'm a social scientist and I do research on teams with people who are natural scientists and do biomedical research also. And so I research with people who have a different perspective who wouldn't share my same critique of this idea that there is a truth that can be measured. Like I work with people like that all the time. And usually that involves like not asserting my perspective on them, interestingly. But that's because this is a marginal also like within the academy, this perspective in science is not as dominant as this idea that is the way like that mainstream medical research is done. So it's complicated. It's actually it's an interesting it's a really interesting question. Like how do you work with people really like how do you work with people who have a different fundamental worldviews is really the question that we need to figure out, right, as we become more divided as we are right now.
Well, and
I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer to that question.
no, that was a great answer, and we are just about out of time. So this is where I say I have to have you back on the podcast, and let us address that exact question, because collaboration is a very big buzzword in the agri-food sector, and I think there's an opportunity to kind of call people's bluff, to call the sector's bluff. Vis-a-vis the argument that I've been making today, because I'm conscious that we literally only have a few minutes left, I want to get to the last two questions that I try to ask every guest and then ask you to answer them as quickly or succinctly as you can with the knowledge that if you desire, you'll have the opportunity to revisit this again in the future. But are there any like policies? This the question. Usually, the way I frame it to people is, I've just seized the Prime Minister's office. I now have executive and legislative power. What is the policy that you think would have the biggest impact in terms of advancing some of the issues we've discussed today, or the ones that are most relevant to the agri-food sector?
Well, part of my research that I haven't spoken about today has been on produce supply chains and specifically the Ontario Food Terminal, which is an example of public food system infrastructure. And so I think that the public is what we need to take with us now from different examples of food system models. I think right now what we need is public infrastructure at a time of great corporate consolidation where you have increasingly large companies that control more and more of different all sorts of aspects of the food system, that we need to ensure that there's more that there's more public good possible. And through that, I do believe that public food system infrastructure can do that. So the Ontario Food Terminal is an example of that. because it enables a diversity of farmers and other businesses, retailers, small, micro, and mid-scale, and even quite large, to participate in the Canadian food economy. And that, in our research has shown, it provides all sorts of goods, such as, enables more regional farmers to have an outlet for their food with more customers. When we followed the food through the food terminal, we found that in neighborhoods, people were buying actually food that cost less from a certain sector of the retail world, like these micro sellers. It was actually costing less, and it was more culturally significant. And when I was there, I witnessed other values of the food. Like, we often think about price, which is super important, but there are also other values too. Like is the food that I'm purchasing, is it what I want to eat? And other things too, like community. Like, for example, I one day I was doing an observation, just doing field work, and at a micro cellar in a social housing complex, and I was going to go buy some vegetables, and then I thought, oh, I made the offhand comment, oh, I can't buy today, I forgot my wallet. And a woman I didn't know turned to me and said, would you like me to lend you money? Like, that's never happened to me at a major chain supermarket before. That's just one tiny anecdote, but it speaks to what we saw, which was like another role that food and food systems plays, which is supporting community and other values. And that's where the public food system infrastructure comes in, because it could be a food terminal, it could be a public market. The City of Toronto has passed a policy to get more public markets, one for every neighborhood. This is, again, a way to have this inclusion in our food system. And so that's why something, public, if you were making policy, that's what I'd ask for. Interestingly, this national food security strategy has funded, it seems, two new food terminals and food hubs. So we'll see how public these turn out to be.
Right on. And then the last question really is the shout outs. This is, not meant to be like the Academy Awards where you list a whole bunch of names, but it's like the what is the future? It's like the gut response. Who are the people you think we should be paying attention to that, maybe inspire you, pique your curiosity, or you just want to say, hey, yeah, you should check these folks out?
Well, if I come back, I'm going to come back with a reading list of wonderful things to read. I can never remember off the top of my head, but there's so many people's books that I've read and articles that I've learned from, and that I've just metabolized and reformulated into what I've said today. So that list is very long. But in terms of as a being a researcher, journalist versus now an academic, I'll tell you, the research assistants I work with have enabled me to do this research. Like, and it's, we do this research together, and they're students, and they work for me for a little bit, and then they graduate and they move on. And so they are the people that I would want to recognize the most, because we had like 5 South Asian languages spoken on our project so far. And they are coming up with solutions and problems and questions that I learn from them all the time. And I know that sounds corny and canned, but it's true. Like, working as in a team is like really fun and really exciting. And that's different than having written a book all by myself. This is like a really group effort.
Well, and shout out the labor that makes these things possible, the way that the more people in the kitchen, often the greater meal. I know you got to go, so thank you very much, Sarah. This has been absolutely fantastic. And to your point, we really only scratched the surface, so we have to do this again soon. In fact, I'm thinking about organizing a panel of radical food researchers with your friend Charles and some others, so maybe that'll be the next opportunity to do so. Thanks again.
Thanks, Jesse. That was really fun.
The good news is we did actually hold that food studies panel. It was fantastic. Expect it as an episode coming up in the weeks to come. The bad news is Sarah wasn't able to make that panel, which is unfortunate because Sarah's perspective is fantastic. I mean, on the one hand, you can judge a society based on how it treats its most vulnerable. On the other hand, you can judge an individual by what they choose to do on a Friday night. Because the thing about Friday night is it's often when we are most free, or mostly religiously devout, depending on how you swing. But to choose to study the microbiome, to spend your Friday nights reading research about the bacteria that sustains us, that's exactly the kind of curious individual that belongs in the future herd. And Sarah's wide-ranging critical perspective is, again, exactly the kind of knowledge and, most importantly, talent that the agri-food sector requires. It's one of the reasons, moving forward, you're going to hear from people like her. But the other takeaway from the episode today was the role of theory. I mean, not just critical theory. Obviously, those of us who are critical like critical theory. But even if criticism's not your thing, you still rely upon theory. A theory of farming, a theory of markets, a theory of communication, a theory of soil, a theory of livestock, a theory of which podcast to listen to. Theory frames so much of our world, so much of our lives. I'll give a shout out here to the podcast Why Theory, W-H-Y. It's quite an interesting exercise, a little indulgent at times, but a good literacy in terms of the role of philosophy. And that's also something I think that the future herd can contribute to the larger agri-food sector. Not just the knowledge that we're generating and distributing, not just the expertise that we're recognizing, nor the talent that we're assembling. No, it's also the theory. The literacy of theory and understanding that theory governs everything, so we should all be theorists. We should all be thinking and criticizing and understanding our systems in new ways. That's a kind of literacy I think that we can excel at here at the Future Herd and facilitate amongst the sector as a whole. Thanks again to Sarah Elton. I do expect you'll be hearing more from her here on the Future Herd podcast. And while we did take a bit of a break due to heat and a little bit of holidays, we've got a bunch of episodes in the archive ready to drop. So expect some real bangers, some really phenomenal stuff in the days and weeks to come. Okay, we'll talk to you soon.